Blog Talk Radio.
All right. Good evening, everybody, and welcome. It's 11 p.m., Wednesday, February 5th, 2020, and thanks for joining us for the 84th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Apologies for this evening starting off a little peculiar. We have some technical difficulties going on with the account that we're running the show from. So we will only be on for about a half hour tonight. We beg our listeners' indulgence. We will get the information to you that we can. And then what we don't finish tonight, we will be back in 2 weeks to give you. So a special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. I will not be doing the sound effects or our usual music because that is one of the things that we need to adjust on the account. So please bear with me. So we do welcome Dr. Mathis. Yes, and he can welcome himself with his lovely music. So we'll be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show, which will only be a half hour tonight, 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. The show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. The views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. That one, because I don't have my audience applause. Very much appreciated, as always. And if you wouldn't mind, please let us know the name of that song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic.
Well, I thought I'd do a little tongue-in-cheek song this evening and accomplish a deep cut as well. So, as you can probably tell from the tone and the riffology of the guitar, that's an old AC/DC song. Off Let There Be Rock, and they did it off the live recording as well, and it's called Dog Eat Dog.
Oh, Lord. And just, okay.
And since we're talking about service animals this evening, I thought that would be kind of a cute little segue into our
the only eating of dogs will be musically.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's cute. I like that. Oh, and as you all know, Dr. Mathis does love his puns, but we put up with him anyway.
Okay.
Before we begin our discussion tonight, let's first go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalled, a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
Well, tonight I want to give a shout-out. A couple of weeks ago, as most of the world knows by now, we lost a really amazing percussionist, Neil Peart of Rush, who had been suffering with a brain cancer. And it was kept pretty much hush-hush until he finally passed about a month or so ago. So I thought I would do sort of an obit on Neil and give sort of a shout out, a little bit of his history, and my condolences to the band, of course, and to his family. Rush is one of my all-time favorite bands, and I just absolutely love Neil's percussionist abilities. But even beyond that, most people may not be aware that he was the band's lyricist. So most of the lyrics that came with the Rush songs after their first recording were written by Neil. So it's really, I mean, he was a major impact on the band and the kind of stuff that they wrote. So originally, like the rest of the his compadres, Neil's from Canada and grew up in kind of a small, born originally in Hamilton, but moved, grew up in Port Dalhousie, now part of St. Catharines. I probably mispronounced that. early, really didn't get into music until his adolescence, and he started listening to the radio and was very much influenced by a lot of classic rock guys of the time, people like John Bonham and Ginger Baker and Keith Moon. Later in his career, he got very much influenced by jazz drummers like Gene Krupa and Buddy Rich, but in the early days, he was definitely much more a rocker. Eventually convinced his parents, after banging on drums with chopsticks and spoons and anything he could, that they would buy him a small kind of a drum kit. I think he ended up with basically a pair of drumsticks and a practice drum, and they got him some lessons and said, hey, if you stick with this for a year and get better, we'll buy you a drum kit. So that started out around age 13, and then on his 14th birthday, he started taking lessons, and eventually got really, really good got a drum kit for his 14th birthday. The chopsticks obviously worked, and started taking lessons at the Peninsula Conservatory of Music, and then started playing out. Got a job part-time at a amusement park called Lakeside Park, which is on the shores of Lake Ontario, which of course goes with the song that he wrote much later in his career off the Caress of Steel album. Really, really great tune. By his own account, he didn't last very long there because of certain things that went down. But at any rate, he got a taste of the working life, and I think decided the drums were a better way for him to go. So he was played in various bands in Canada, and basically got frustrated. So he went to London to live for a while, thinking that if he went there, he could further his career. And he got kind of frustrated with the stuff over there. While he got, you know, jobs playing in some bands, and I think did some studio work, session work as well, he ended up working selling jewelry at a shop called The Great Frog, which was on Carnaby Street. That's also where he got introduced to Ayn Rand, the novelist, and where he got very much influenced by a lot of her writings on objectivism and individualism, which a lot of his lyrics come from, particularly in the Fly By Night record. So he moves back to Canada, kind of disillusioned, and gets a job in his father's, hunting goods shop and sporting goods and, you know, tractors and that sort of thing. And so he was playing with some local bands Hardware store. Hello, sounds like. It sounds like.
That's okay.
Most of you listeners probably know I have anomia, and every now and then words just kind of get out of my head, and I'm like, oh my God, what the hell? So, at any rate, through a mutual acquaintance, he learned that the band in Toronto, Rush, who was playing around and on the verge of getting a major record deal, their drummer, John Rutsey, was diabetic and, from all accounts, didn't have the greatest dietary habits. And their manager at the time said, hey, if you guys go out on the road with this guy, he's going to come back in a body bag. And so they had to replace him. And one of Neil's acquaintances convinced him to go and apply, you know, sort of apply for the job. And then he went and jammed with Alex and Geddy, and of course the rest is history. You got, I think his first drum kit that he played a gig with them was a Slingerland kit, if I'm not mistaken, and they were opening, I think, for Manfred Mann's Earth Band and Uriah Heep. And from there,
wow.
The rest is sort of history. Yeah. And from there, I think that was in 1974. And from there, you know, things just kind of progressed. Geddy Lee and Alex Lifeson wrote most of the music for the first record, and they really hated, by Geddy's all accounts and Geddy's memoirs, hated writing lyrics. And they kept seeing Neil, you know, going back to the room and reading stuff and all this heady stuff, and they go, I bet that guy could write lyrics. And so he became the band's lyricist, and they really liked it. And they go, well, great, we'll let him do that shit. We'll write the music. So that was kind of the division of labor that got set up. And from then on, Neil wrote the vast majority of their lyrics, and Geddy and Alex wrote most of the music. So it was a really nice combination, and kind of from there things took off. And of course, with their release of 2112, that really kind of propelled them into stardom. And from there, things just kind of went up. Most people don't know that in the early 90s, Buddy Rich's daughter contacted Neil to do a record in kind of to praise her dad who had passed away. And so Buddy, we're doing a recording called Burning for Buddy, which was a tribute CD where they were doing a bunch of classic-y jazz stuff, and they had all these drummers from a bunch of different rock bands coming in and playing Buddy Rich music. So they had, you know, the guy for Steve Smith, who was the Journey drummer, and had the guy for Guns and the Cult coming in, and, you know, all these different drummers. So Buddy got kind of interested in that, and Steve Smith's Journey's drummer, they did actually two recordings, and they came back and did one in 94 and one in 97. And Neil had noticed that Steve Smith's drumming had taken like a decided turn for the better, even though he was a decent drummer, obviously, to begin with. So Neil goes, hey, what the hell? You know, in a couple of years, your drumming is like skyrocketed. And so Steve Smith says, yeah, I got hold of this guy, Freddie Gruber, who's this drum a teacher in New York City, and he's kind of the guru and yada yada. So Neil went to him and said, hey, you know, will you give me some lessons? And so he started taking a bunch of lessons with Freddie, who kind of really put him on kind of a more jazzy kind of thing, and he started implementing those kind of riffs into his own playing. And then came back and with, you know, and kind of brought some of that back to Rush. So if you look into the stuff after that time period, he really, you can hear slight changes in little jazz riffs that he wasn't doing before, and kind of the way he's holding the sticks. And he's got a couple of CDs out, the drum CDs, which are really great. And he talks about some of that in the CDs. It's really, really cool. And of course, in 97, during just after the Test for Echo tour, his daughter, he was married, Neil was married at the time for his first marriage, and his first daughter, 19 years old, was killed in a car accident. And his wife at the time, something like 10 years later, ends up dying of cancer. So it was really kind of a rough time for Neil. And that's when he took off and did his motorcycle ride and took like a 2-year hiatus. And he's got a memoir that he wrote on his travels. It's pretty intense stuff. It's called Ghost Rider Travels on the Healing Road. He talks about what he did on his motorcycle ride through the United States and parts of Canada and stuff. And at any rate, returned and released the album Vapor Trails, and they started back playing again. And then sometime in late 2015, near the end of their tour, Neil had announced he was going to retire, and people thought, okay, he's just taking another break, yada, yada, yada. And, you know, he said he was having chronic tendonitis and shoulder problems. And Alex, my understanding is Alex has some kind of rheumatoid arthritis or whatever that he's suffering from. So they said, okay, well, we'll take a break or whatever. And, you know, because Alex says, oh, he'll be back. Well, I think in early 2018, in an interview, Alex Lifeson said, yeah, it's basically done. But nobody knew that Neil was suffering from glioblastoma, which is a form of brain cancer, which is what he eventually died from on January the 7th of this year. So it was really, really, really sad. It's clearly the end of an era. And I said to a buddy of mine that he's really kind of one of the last of the uber great classic rock drummers, because, you know, we don't have John Bonham anymore, and Ginger Baker died a couple of years ago, who was one of my all-time favorite guys. And Keith Moon, of course, died a while ago. And we still have, you know, Stuart Copeland, who's a tremendous drummer, and, you know, Michael Shreve, and, you know, Phil Collins and some of those folks. Michael Giles is still around, the drummer for King Crimson, original drummer for King Crimson, Steve Gadd. But it's just really sad to me that a guy with that much talent passed so early. I think he was 67 years old. And it's just really, really sad.
Wow.
Yeah. And it is really, his death has really hit me really hard, because Rush has been one of my major influences, both writing style, and I just always loved, just really loved Neil's genius, from a guy who didn't have a lot of education. And it's kind of a nice reminder. And if I say to my patients all the time, IQ is overrated. And, you know, here's an example of somebody who you expect, you know, is going to go to school. If you're gifted, you're going to go to school and do all this kind of stuff. And Neil didn't do any of that stuff. And yet, if you read his lyrics, they are just incredibly profound. And of course, his drumming was stellar, and arguably one of the best rock drummers of his era, if not the best rock drummer of his era. Didn't want to take up the whole show with that, but I did want to put out a shout, because I just felt like it's a great loss to the music community, and certainly to his family. He remarried since then and has had another daughter, and actually became got an American citizenship in 2010. At any rate, he was living in California at the time with his second wife and daughter. So anyway, that's kind of the story. So I wanted to share that with listeners who didn't know. And if you're out there and you haven't listened to a bunch of Rush, or you like the music but you hadn't really listened to the lyrics, go back and get a copy of the lyrics. They will blow you away. They're amazing.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Well, thank you for that. Again, giving the manual applause, you know, because I don't have my waves, but very deserved.
Okay.
You know, definitely respect to Neil's family, and you know, I really loved his stuff. Although, interestingly, my favorite song is one of their later ones, and it's probably just because I haven't extensively listened to their old stuff. I'm very fond of Bravado off of Roll the Bones, which is a much newer piece, and I know he did the lyrics for that one.
Yeah.
So anyhow, since we have a short show, let's go ahead and move on to the topic. And what we will probably do is pause when we get to 11:30, and then we'll do the rest in 2 weeks. So as Dr. Mathis was alluding to earlier, tonight's episode is entitled Dogs of War, Service Dogs and Emotional Support Animals. And there's a nod to Iron Maiden in there, which we'll discuss in a moment. Okay, so before we begin we already did the trivia, excuse me, so let me skip down. So we'll take calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the rest of the evening, which is about 12 minutes. And then please feel free to give us a call. The number is 914-338-0314. And those of you listening tonight, I encourage you to come back in 2 weeks and hear the second half of the show, and we will complete the stuff that we have to say on this topic, because it is extensive. So tonight's show is called Dogs of War, Service Dogs and Emotional Support Animals. So the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, was passed and signed into law by President George H.W. Bush in July of 1990. It has undergone many additions and revisions over the years as various scenarios and test court cases bring up new aspects the law affects, and decisions must be made for future similar situations. One section of the law that many people have at least heard of, but also that an unfortunate many greatly misinterpret and misunderstand, is the service animal section. By now, your average person knows it exists, and most people attempt to comply and be understanding. But there exists a lot of bad and misleading information, incomplete information, changing and updated information, and all under the umbrella of a non-existent central governing or regulating entity. Then, just to make things even more confusing, there are emotional service animals, which many people think or feel should be the same thing, and they are not. And there are hundreds of fraudulent companies on eBay, Amazon, and many other places offering certifications and insignia to make your service animal, quote, official, taking advantage that your average person has no idea that they have zero authority to do this. So tonight, and possibly next week, 2 weeks from now, we will walk our listeners through our understanding of service dogs and emotional support animals from the owner's side and from the public side, and discuss our layperson's understanding of these designations. As always, please be advised that we are neither lawyers nor judges, and our listeners are strongly encouraged to personally re-verify any information or advice we give before acting on it in public. So in the complete show, we will discuss defining service animals, emotional service animals, and ADA laws. Second, pathologies that could require service dogs versus ESAs. Third, training registry myths and abuses of the current law. And fourth, resources for getting ESAs, service dogs, or info on how to interact with someone who has one. Before we get started, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis. We've got about 8 minutes left.
No, I'm good. And thanks for suggesting this is a great topic, by the way.
No problem. Actually, I have to give the internet credit because I was on a chat app and this topic keeps getting discussed and there's a lot of arguing about it. And it just made it clear to me that while I work in social media and I know these people are saying comments just to troll and be rude, but they get away with it because there is misperception and the law is ham-fisted. And we're going to talk about these things tonight. This was done in good intention, but it was done quickly and incompletely. And the people who need these animals and the people who are trying to navigate what's legal and what's not are struggling because of the sloppiness of how this was executed. So let's go ahead and start talking about this. A few minutes we have left. We want to define service animals, emotional service animals, and the ADA laws for you guys. And I may or may not get through all of this. I'll do the best I can, and I'll cut it off at a stopping point, and then we'll come back to it. So the U.S. Department of Justice is the body who oversees this at all. The Civil Rights Division, Disability Rights Section, ADA requirements. Covers this. The ADA service dog law, this has been updated as of 2011. That's the most recent version. And one of the problems is some things that people learned have since been updated and changed. Quick example that's not in my script, you hear about things like, oh, my emotional service peacock had to go on the airplane. And that actually really happened and caused a great big drama. So they've redefined a bunch of things that weren't originally defined in the law. This is one example of dozens of how this got messy. So the Department of Justice published revised final regulations implementing the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, for Title II, which is state and local government services, and Title III, which is public accommodations and commercial facilities like restaurants or parks. On September 15th, 2010, in the Federal Register. That means they updated the stuff from 1990 that Bush put into law, Bush the senior. These requirements or rules clarify and redefine issues that have arisen over the last 20 years and contain new and updated requirements, including the 2010 Standards for Accessible Design. So this publication provides guidance on the term service animal and the service animal provisions in the department's new regulations. Beginning on March 15, 2011, only dogs are recognized as service animals under Titles II and III of the ADA. There's a small exception at the end of this section. If I get to it tonight, I'll explain it. It happens to be horses, but I digress. A service animal is a dog that is individually trained to do work or perform tasks for a person with a disability. It must be all of these things. Number one, how service animal is defined. We've got about 6 minutes. Service animals are defined as dogs that are individually trained to do work or perform tasks for people with disabilities. Examples of such work or tasks include guiding people who are blind, alerting people who are deaf, pulling a wheelchair, alerting and protecting a person who's having a seizure, reminding a person with mental illness to take prescribed medications, calming a person with PTSD during an anxiety attack, or performing lots of other duties. Service animals are working animals. They are not pets. The work or task a dog has been trained to provide must be directly related to the person's disability. Dogs whose sole function is to provide comfort or emotional support do not qualify as service animals under the ADA. This definition does not affect or limit the broader definition of assistance animal under the Fair Housing Act, which I have a section on and we may not get to tonight, or the broader definition of service animal under the Air Carrier Access Act, which I also have a section on that we may not get to tonight, and I will fully explain those later. Some states and local laws also define service animal more broadly than the ADA does. Information about such laws can be obtained from the state attorney general's office. I was legally fuzzy as to whether a state law can define it more narrowly than the ADA does, and I will try to find out the answer before we come back in 2 weeks, and I'll let you guys know what I find. All right, we got about 4 minutes. Next section, where service animals are allowed. Big point of contention. I'm going to actually pause real quick and check in with you, Dr. Mathis. Is there anything you want to jump in here with? Because we don't have too much time. I want to give you a chance.
No, I'll save my dillies for next time.
Okay, cool. All right, so where service animals are allowed. Under the ADA, state and local governments, businesses, and nonprofit organizations that serve the public generally must allow service animals to accompany people with disabilities in all areas of the facility where the public is normally allowed to go. For example, in a hospital, it would be inappropriate to exclude a service animal from areas such as patients' rooms, clinics, cafeterias, or exam rooms. Generally, Title II and Title III entities must permit service animals to accompany people with disabilities in all areas where members of the public are allowed to go. And ADA Title II or III, state or local government is Title II again. Public accommodation is Title III, like a restaurant, doctor's office, retail store, hotel, etc. This is not noted in the ADA, but in addition, when flying, you and your service dog will be granted in-cabin seating of an airplane at no extra cost to you. Not all airline staff know this, and it does not apply to emotional support animals. However, there may be some restrictions placed on your service dog's accessibility. These include hospital ICU or other areas where special clothing is required, operating rooms or burn units where the animal's presence may compromise a sterile environment, treatment area of an ambulance, same problem, restricted areas on a military base, that actually kind of constitutes not really public, and zoo exhibit, where the service animal may upset the animals of the exhibit. All right, we've got about 2 minutes left. The next portion I may not get fully through, so we'll get through a chunk of it. I'm going to start explaining the Fair Housing Act to you, which is HUD, the Office of Fair Housing and Equal Opportunity. So the Fair 90 seconds. I tell you what, I'm not going to get into that so that I can fully kind of wrap this for you guys. We'll explain this next time. The Fair Housing Act has to do with being allowed to bring these animals into a living space when it's a no pets. Like, say you're renting an apartment, but you need the animal, and it's a piece of a medical equipment. So the laws have to be worded in such a way to allow this. And we'll talk about that next time. We're going to cover the Air Carrier Act and a whole bunch of other information. You guys and miniature horses. We'll talk about pathologies that could require service dogs. We will talk about the training and registry and myths and abuses of the current law. And then we'll talk about resources for getting these animals if you think you need one. And also how to deal with people that have one, because a lot of people don't know. So we really appreciate you guys' patience tonight. Dr. Mathis, do you have anything else that you want to say to our listeners before we go?
No, I'm good, and we'll finish this up next time.
Yes, we will. Thank you, guys. I don't have any lovely closing music for you guys, as I usually do, but I very much appreciate your patience. We have just a few seconds left in this evening, so I hope you will join us in 2 weeks We will be back on February 19th. We will be celebrating my birthday, so bring your party attitude. Hopefully we will have our online account fixed up, and we will be back in black as we usually are. Thank you for joining us. Have a wonderful evening. Yep. See you guys next time.